Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the latest episode of the El Arpa podcast. Thank you for tuning in. And joining me in studio, of course, is Mary. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So our last podcast was with Warren Batts, the head of Serve the City. So we've completed a trilogy of interviews. He was the last one. Before him, Robbie Dunn, him of Ireland, ass, and Roy Vallecano, and his book Working Class Heroes. And of course, the very first one that kicked us all off, Hans Zimmer's orchestra, and three musicians, El Amir, Snow Owl, and Gavin Greenaway. So so if you haven't checked out those episodes, I recommend that you check them out after this one. And we can also plug our blog article in the first part. Normally that's part three, but we've been promoting it on Facebook. And you've just seen that it's been shared by an American woman. Yeah? Or where is she from?
She's Spanish.
Oh, she's Spanish.
Yeah, but she lived in Ireland and other places.
Oh, really? Yeah. Ah, okay. And you don't know her. We just gleaned that information from her Facebook page.
Kind of.
Wow, social media.
We just had a quick look.
Exactly.
She volunteered that information.
Yeah, so we are promoting your article that we mentioned in other podcasts, Oats of a Strange Language, the story of how Spanish translators translated Irish literature of James Synge. And who else?
Mainly James Synge. It was just like two different Spanish authors were interested in him and kind of like were influenced by him or translated him or both.
Exactly. And she also followed some of her other stories, one about Irish students who brought football to the north of Spain. And that is also an interesting story. If you want to check out more of those, go to irishsliceofmadrid.com. That is our blog URL. There will be a link in the description as well. Speaking of Facebook, have you seen the deep fake of Mark Zuckerberg this week?
No.
That's why I refer to him as a robot on our WhatsApp conversation yesterday. I knew you probably hadn't seen it, so
I still followed on from what you said.
Yeah, well, basically, this deepfake thing is where people can make videos of a personality, and I guess they could do it of anybody, really. Mm. And the mannerisms, the voice, the look, all seems legitimate, but in reality, it's a simulation. It's not really that person saying those things. And what's interesting about Facebook is Nancy Pelosi, or Nasty Nancy, to quote Donald Trump, even though that's not my opinion, of course. There was a deepfake video of her a few months ago on Facebook, and Facebook wouldn't take it down.
Yeah.
And now this kind of protest group have made a deepfake of Mark Zuckerberg, where he's very malevolent. Well, is that a deep fake or actually really him? It's hard to tell if he's being if he's being malevolent, and or malevolent, I should say. They are, well, in that simulation, that deep fake, he's talking about how he's gotten all his power from an organization called Spectre, which I imagine is a reference to James Bond, this kind of shadow organization.
And because he has some familia.
And how he owns all the data in the world. So it's kind of a test of Facebook's wherewithal, whether they'll take this down. If they do, will that create a precedent, and perhaps they will kind of regulate this a lot more. But we're all familiar with Facebook, how they don't have enough staff to control. I know this is on record that they don't have enough staff to monitor offensive content online. And by offensive, I don't mean somebody giving their opinion about something controversial, but genuinely shocking things that people can live stream on Facebook and things like that.
Well, I think they don't even attempt it because they always say that it's just too complicated to monitor the whole thing, and so I'm not sure they even actually try.
Yeah, they probably don't. But it's interesting because Facebook, I'm assuming the headquarters is in San Francisco. Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, well, but because San Francisco has become the first city. I'm not sure. It's a city on the West Coast that have banned facial recognition. So deep fakes, facial recognition is a very interesting concept because these are technologies that we are capable of producing. But just because we can produce them doesn't mean we really should. And it's interesting to see how it's developing now, the kickback to that, and how there's a little bit of regulation coming in. And if facial recognition can be banned in one place, presumably it can be done in other places. And maybe there'll be more regulation for things like deepfake and these emerging technological trends that aren't really beneficial for a lot of people, don't seem to have any obvious utility. And it's just very... You know, I mean, it just proves what you can do, but in reality, it's hard to see how it serves society. And very often you can say, well, by banning it, you can see a very obvious utility for people in general, you know. So anyway, that's Facebook and our article. A bit of a tangent. So we were also in Feria del Libro, the book fair in the Retiro, El Parque Buen Retiro. And what were your impressions of that park and the book fair?
I thought it was very lively this year. We've been some of the years during the week at like 6 o'clock, and for some reason every year it rains, even if it's meant to be really sunny at this time. But this year I got the impression that it was very lively. They were doing the usual interviews with the authors and book signing and all this, but it was full of people just buying books and checking books out. So
we played Spot the Author because in some of the kiosks they had a picture of like autographs from this guy, and then he was there underneath it, and we're like, that photo is from 20 years ago. So a bit cruel from us, but
well, that's fun.
Also we noticed that Fnac had a stall.
And
Fnac are maybe like Barnes and Noble. If you're a Yank, I don't know, or if you're an American, like a big chain store, bookstore. So it's kind of strange because normally it's like independent booksellers that go to this fair, not actually huge chains, but, you know, they're out of the way, I guess, a little bit. They had the worst kiosk, to be honest with you. I'm not sure how that happens.
Well, it was one of the biggest, but it wasn't very nicely organized. I think the whole thing about the stands is that you can... Well, you're very close, like there's only a few books or sometimes a lot, but...
But you can talk to the...
You can talk to the publisher or the editor and then discuss the books and they give you information and all this. You have a chat.
Yeah.
And the Fnac one was more like the shop, you know. You had shelves and then there were a couple of...
Cold, impersonal, brutish worker bees, more like.
Yeah, I mean, they're just people that work in the shop. But for example, in the other stand that we stopped at, we were talking to the editor, and he was telling us about why he picked those books that he picked, and what the stories were about. So that was quite nice.
And he apparently is running his book operation out of his kitchen.
Yeah, pretty much.
But the books were...
Don't we all?
Yeah, that's true. But they're beautifully organized, and we bought one of them. Well, I bought one of them for you. but I can. It's a tax deductible. It all works out. And it's a story of a bourgeoisie woman. She was bourgeoisie, you know? And she...
Yes.
She fell in love with the Bolshevik ideal, and but then became disillusioned with it.
Yeah.
And was sent to prison, and eventually she's shot by the Soviets. So a happy read there. But you have read a little bit of it. It's going well as a story, no?
So far I read the prologue where it explains how they found this person, how they came about the story, which had been completely forgotten. So this was all through a visit to the islands where this first gulag used to be. And then an old woman there basically showed the author of the book, or the person that put it together, a photo of this woman, and then they started researching her and found out that there were these documents where she basically wrote kind of like an autobiography, because at the beginning she explains where she comes from and how she became interested in revolutionary ideas, which is what I've read so far. And then at some point, I think she's going to start talking about, because she wrote it while she was in prison before being shot. So at some point, I guess she's going to go back to present day. Or
yeah.
At the time, but at the moment, she's just saying how she got to where she is.
Okay, fascinating stuff. So what we'll do is we will take a break there for part two, and we'll join you momentarily after the musical interlude. And I'm speaking slowly because I have a new computer.
I was going to say that was very slow.
And I'm trying to stop the recording. Well, welcome back to part two. We'll start off with some Chernobyl chat, the TV show. We're going to expand on this more in part three, but I have time for one question from my co-presenter here, Mary. Because you know I have a friend from Belarus who came to Ireland with A.D. Roach's Chernobyl Children Project, and you were confused about why they were there. Well, basically, after the fallout from the Chernobyl explosion, the radioactive clouds were going towards Russia. The Russian scientists and, well, the government realized this, and they sent out planes to drop things in the clouds to make it rain to protect Russia from the worst of the radioactive material, and most of that fell on Belarus. So Chernobyl's in Ukraine, but Belarus actually got, I think, the worst of that tragedy. So that's why there's people from Belarus and Ireland for the clean air and the nature to recuperate for a month or so. And yeah, it's very sad actually, because
so it was kind of like the solution in quotes that harmed these people rather than the event itself.
Well, yeah, I mean, for the Soviets, it was always just protect Russia, protect Moscow, and everybody else in the USSR was expendable. So it's just very, it has a, I mean, it's a legacy that has a cast a huge shadow. I mean, the girl I'm thinking of, my friend, but her parents have passed away because of cancers. So yeah, it's a very problematic, and obviously because of the nature of the material, it's something that has a huge impact over a long period of time. Now, so we'll discuss the TV show more in part two, so the more the TV show element of it, but you also read a Forbes article, and well, maybe you can take it off from there and tell us what they said in that Forbes article and in your opinion of that as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm talking to you.
I know. But okay, so yeah, so basically the article, I read it before I watched it, because some person posted on Twitter something about the fact, I think precisely about the fact that so many cases of cancer could have a relation to this event or to this tragedy. And somebody else posted as a response to that an article which was called "Why HBO's Chernobyl Gets So Many Things Wrong About Nuclear Power." So then I thought, okay, well, let's see why, in this person's opinion. So then when I read the article, of course, it's Forbes, which, you know, it kind of like has a certain background that you are to expect. But it sort of focused on showing how a lot of details were wrong. I think the main thing that the author was trying to argue was basically that nuclear power is not as bad, and it's actually the best one of all the energies that we have available.
Yeah, but I mean, that's well and good. But I heard a story today of a plant in Brazil that was left abandoned. Maybe you know the story, and people try to salvage the metal from that plant. And then they painted their bodies with some of the shiny polvo, the kind of dust or whatever that you get from an abandoned building. And of course, they all died from radiation poisoning as well. So, I mean, it's just like a lot of countries have, I mean, for example, you look at the United States, they have collapsing infrastructure. They rely on foreign investment to look after that infrastructure. So, I mean, it's not just whether nuclear power is good or not. I mean, I think, yeah, it probably has a lot going for it, but it's a case of being able to produce it responsibly, maintain the infrastructure. And that's not always a given because countries run out of money or they have budget deficits. I mean, look at New York. Okay, it's never had a nuclear power plant as far as I know, but I mean, how many times have they run in? I mean, they can't even pay for their own metro at the moment. Their public transport is out of money. So I don't know how, like, you know, but you know, these advocates for certain things never really consider, like, it's not just the issue at hand, but the surrounding elements to it as well. Sorry, I jumped on your train of thought there.
No, okay, but I completely agree with you. I mean, I think that's the point. The whole point is that his aim was to prove that, you know. So I think in order to prove that, he was basically trying to say that everything that was told in the series was completely exaggerated. I think there are various... He actually gets some things wrong. I mean, we've talked about how some... artistic licenses are needed when you are portraying an event that it might be difficult for people to understand. But also, there are things, of course, there are like completely inconsequential details, like when we talked about the Green Man, remember we talked about, the Green Man, Green Book. We talked about how the family complained about some details that were very precise, and those things are like not necessarily that important to the story, so it's not a big deal. But also the main thing that that he was going on about, for example, was that the cases of cancer were not significant enough because they've been revised a number of times, and the figures that he dealt with came mainly from the last UN report, which was like 5 years ago or something like that, where they revised some of the information. The problem is that he focused only on this latest report, but the fact is that collects information from the cases that are, let's say, completely 100% accurate that they are related to that. But this is very difficult to measure, of course, because, for starters, because it's been only, 33 years. So this is still ongoing, and a lot of people are getting sick from this at the moment. But also because of the whole apparatus that you were talking about, where a lot of things were like hidden or ignored. So a lot of people that were involved were not quantified for, or were taken as basically collateral damage. So there are a number of sources that are never included in these accounts, which are actually at least partially relevant, so they have to be considered. So even so, I mean, when he's talking about the figures and he's only talking about the 100% sure figures related to direct deaths related to it, he's still saying things like, well, 20% of cancers could possibly be related to this, and then he says, and in reality only one of out of six is certain. And then it's like, well, okay, but you know, it's very I find it very aggravating for those people's families that this is mentioned as kind of like, well, actually it wasn't that important because, you know, only 60 people died directly as a result of it, which were the first responders. And all these other people that are counted in like thousands, like literally it talks about like maybe 6,000 people that died, and those are like the figures that they're talking about. They're like, well, actually, like, it's not a massive incident. And I don't know, it's quite shocking, isn't it? I mean,
Well, it's very strange as well, because it's very obviously, I think, politically motivated. But also, look, when it first happened, I don't think people really realized the true extent of the damage. But slowly, well, not that slowly, I think relatively quickly, people started piecing together the story of the damage of what it actually meant for this nuclear disaster. I mean, in the UK, they started measuring the radioactive levels in vegetation and crops, and they realized that this was a direct result of the Chernobyl explosion. And I mean, I think that if you can produce, and there's even places like all over the world where they've had these clusters of radioactivity and even associated cancers with that radioactivity as well. So if it has this profound effect on faraway places, then you can only assume that the people in the vicinity and relatively close to that explosion are more susceptible to the negative consequences of radioactivity, which would be, of course, cancerous as well. So I think it's to argue otherwise is very peculiar.
Yeah, well, he makes a point of one of the other things that he complains about is the fact that the information that is given by the scientists is wrong, because he talks about, you know, in terms of numbers, how much stronger that radiation is compared to Hiroshima, for example. And the fact is that if you do a little bit of research, then you can easily find out that all those things that the scientist, that the main scientist says in the series, are things that he really believed, because at the time there was no way, it had never happened before. So they could only use models that related to Hiroshima, which was kind of like the closest event similar to that. So in fact, the things that he was saying were inaccurate, but that's what he believed at the time. And I believe that's made obvious in the series afterwards, because there's another character that kind of like offers a bit of contrast with that, which is a female scientist that who's also a historical character.
Yeah. Well, I think as well, it's a curious place, because you do have people who are, well, who refuse to leave the villages that were in the blast zone, or in the zone that would get affected. There are other villages that are completely abandoned, that are ghost villages, effectively. You do have dark tourists going there to see what it's like, and flirting with varying degrees of radioactivity. This zone is very dangerous, you can only spend a certain time here, or this is relatively safe, so you can spend longer time here.
Yeah, it's absurd.
But yeah, exactly. I mean, because it's difficult to draw straight lines around safe areas and not safe areas.
Well,
I think
also, but you know, what is the tourist in interest of that, beyond like being, it's like a morbid interest, it's not.
Well, like, I mean, in one sense, you do have a time capsule element to it, because you can see villages that are frozen in time. But then on the other hand, you are trespassing in people's abandoned lives. So
yeah,
there's an ethical question about that, so it's probably wrong.
Even if you want, you wouldn't take photos. That's my point, you know what I mean?
Well,
you might have a scientific interest, but
yeah, well, people who are taking Instagram photos, as you've seen in Paris,
exactly,
as well. But like, I mean, obviously as well, I'm sure we all know as well about the animals that have thrived there. They live shorter lives, but they are thriving to a certain extent in these areas, because there are no humans, and when there's no humans, nature and animals take over as well. But again, though, I think if your argument is based on it's the safest energy source, and again, I'm sure there are a lot of things going for it. An explosion where a lot of people did die, doesn't matter if it was 10 or 100 because of cancers, is still significant. And also as well, if you have a situation where whole areas have been abandoned, and who knows when you can go back there, well, then that's a question mark that you have to consider, you know. So, but yeah, so we'll talk more, as we said, about the show element of it and the accents in part three. So Normally in our podcast, we have like the main topic in part two and then something extra in part three, but we'll continue with this topic in part three as well. But before we jump to that part after the musical interlude, do you have anything else you want to add about Chernobyl? The Forbes article, nuclear energy?
No, I think, we'll examine some other aspects, I think, next week, because we'll be watching the rest of the series. And
talking more loudly about it.
Yes, and talking more loudly about it and more in depth.
Okay, very good. And here's where we reveal, before we've seen the credit sequence, and we haven't seen any of it. Only joking. Okay, so part three it is, coming up now. Hello, I'm a character in Chernobyl. Do you like my Ukrainian accent?
It's lovely, my dear.
Jolly good. Now I'm taking the train to Kiev. So yeah, it's a strange thing. I gather that most people really like the fact that they're speaking in not fake accents. But I've never had a problem with that personally in movies. I mean, if you think of that movie with Daniel Craig and Liev Schreiber, I think, Defiance, when they're playing Belarusian resistance fighters in the Second World War, they're speaking with accents. And yeah, for me, it's not a problem. It's not like...
it's not a problem for you because you're Irish and all movies get your accent wrong. So you're used to it.
That's true, most of them do. But no, to be honest...
No, I agree with you.
There's a podcast for Chernobyl where the writer talks about all this stuff and he says, like, when you do a Russian accent, you act Russian, and that's a problem for the character. But I don't know, I mean, obviously, well, okay, they're Ukrainian, not Russian, but if you have a Ukrainian accent, then I don't see what the problem is if you act Ukrainian. Isn't that part of it? But obviously they know more about it than I do. I guess what it is, if you're doing an accent that you're not familiar with it, you're going to do a blanket accent, kind of a generic neutral one, without any like regional variance. So if someone was doing an Irish accent or a Spanish accent, they would do a very standard and middle of the road one. But of course, in every country, you have so many variances in terms of dialect and pronunciation and how things are spoken. That you probably would lose that. But then again, if you have actors who really care about the role, and I don't know, Daniel Day-Lewis, who went mad and lived in Ukraine for 5 years in preparation or something, like, you would learn maybe little inflections that would give your character a little extra identity.
Well, I think there's an issue of class as well, because I remember when I was in the UK, I taught a couple of people from the Ukraine, and they were horrified when I talked about, you know, whether there were like any specific things about their accent and stuff like that, because they say they spoke Russian. And although, you know, Ukrainian was only spoken by like the lowest classes, and they almost found it offensive that, you know, you would suggest they didn't speak like standard proper Russian, which was like the language of, you know, the upper class.
Well, it's a real... That's a tragedy. That's a heartbreaking.
Yeah,
it
was really... I was really shocked.
That's a victory of cultural imperialism.
Yeah,
of,
but they were almost offended. And yeah. I've met, you know, a few people from, like, ex-USSR that, yeah, they considered themselves Russian, and they were really, in a way, almost offended that you suggested that, you know, they would speak... their own language or dialect, and
this is how they do it. They put that germ in your brain that your native language is wrong, and it's horrifying that that stays, and it does, of course, it stays in families, and it stays in societies, and it doesn't get eradicated even after the collapse of the political system. Those insidious cultural techniques of domination still persist, and we're all too familiar with that as well. I'll give you an interesting example of that in a sense. Alexander the Great, Oliver Stone's movie starring Connor, I was going to say Conor McGregor, Colin Farrell.
Close enough.
They're both from Dublin, and yeah, they're both performers of some description. And now it's a movie that isn't very good in its theatrical release, but the director's cut does salvage it to a degree as a story. But basically,
story more than history.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, and but anyway, so like some of the I can't remember who it was exactly, but a group of people speak with Irish accents, and a very famous actor called Mick Lally, who's in an Irish soap opera called Glenroe, he was one of the characters who had a speaking part, and a lot of people were laughing at this because everybody grew up with Americans and British playing Romans and other characters in the sandal and sword epics of the 50s and the 60s as well. And there's something very, not to sound like a mad Marxist or anything, but kind of like culturally oppressive as well. It's like of assuming, because they assume politically that they are the new Romans, you know, both those empires. And so they see that as their exclusive domain, and any accent that isn't conforming to that is a source of ridicule. But in reality, we don't know what their accents sound like, and if all the group of people are consistent in having the one accent, and in this sense it means, okay, they all have an Irish accent, but it could be a Mexican accent or whatever, you know, then in the context of the story, then as a narrative, it makes sense, it has a coherence. So language is, I see it all the time here in Spain as well, as a foreigner speaking Irish English, and then the other versions of English try and intrude in that as well. So it is a battleground, not for me, not for Irish people, but for other people where they try and kind of dominate you, your soul, through that. Didn't mean to talk about this, I want to talk about Chernobyl.
Yeah, well, it's related.
Well, it's ironic though as well, because like Ukraine had a very strong anti-Soviet feeling, and if you watch documentaries from the 90s even, before, or even from the 80s before the collapse of the Soviet Union, you can see that shining through. While Belarus, for example, today has a very pro-Russian government. But I know people from Belarus, and they were over in Ireland with us because they were also victims of Chernobyl and the Chernobyl Children's Fund. And if you call them Russian, they would like, we're not, like, we're just, what are you talking about, you know? So it's kind of funny how Ukraine, I think politically and just in the context of the Soviet times, there's a very strong nationalist feeling there. I don't know what it was like in Belarus, but post-independence, I think Ukraine has been strongly independent, more or less, you know, in towing, it's kind of like powering through its own line, you know, while Belarus has stayed in the orbit of the Soviet Union. But just from anecdotal evidence, it seems like there's a strong element of Ukrainians who feel Russian, perhaps, but in Belarus there are people who have a strong separate identity as well. But that's just anecdotal evidence based on the people I've met. It's not necessarily...
I think it's definitely... Or there's definitely a class element there, you know, because the people that I'm talking to you about, like, were in, like, you mainly in UK universities. So, you know, they were, like, upper-class people, you know, while perhaps, like, I don't know, maybe, like, the people that you were in contact with were sort of, like, a more normal... down to earth group of people.
Well, my uncle works as a Ukrainian. I think he comes from a relatively humble background, and he has a strong Russian bias or a feeling or whatever. But I did know a Ukrainian here in Madrid, and she spoke about the famines of, well, the Soviet collectivizations, basically under Stalin, killed a lot of people, and Ukraine was adversely affected by that as well. So she was someone who felt, and quite justifiably as well, a historical reaction to that, you know. So she obviously wasn't someone who had a pro-Russian leaning, you know. But anyway, I've always seen the first episode. Is it good? Everybody's saying it's good, Chernobyl.
I'm enjoying it so far. I mean, I think it's an episode that...
how come you haven't watched it all? It's just five episodes.
How come I haven't watched it all?
Yeah. Because one in five workers miss work because of Netflix binges.
Okay, but like, how could you watch half an episode and not finish it? That's even worse.
Because I was busy.
Ah, so I was busy too. That's why I only watched two at the weekend. Saturday, Sunday. Yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying it so far. Some people have complained that it's a bit slow.
Yeah,
maybe.
Me.
But yeah, well, I suppose at the beginning, it just takes a while to get into the whole mood. But I felt like the second episode was already, you know, getting farther with the story. And I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's been criticized both for being sensationalist.
Sensationalist.
And also for like not being exciting enough, so that you can't win. I mean, but this is like, I think this is a historical event. Like, it's based on like real events, and yeah, it's a very like serious topic that still affects a lot of people. So I think it just has to be told in a measured way. You cannot make it super exciting, and
yeah,
there's also gonna be an element that is gonna, because for example, one of the things that they were criticizing, and I think we can say this safely because it's not
we can say louder
yeah, but it's not I mean, if you haven't watched it, it's not a big deal because that shows in like minute two. But one of the things they were complaining were about the fact that people were bleeding, and then like radiation never caused bleeding, for example. And okay, that might be the case, but they were complaining on the paper that that goes against accuracy. But at the end of the day, also there are some things that I think you need to use in order to, for people to understand the story. So radiation is something that a lot of the time affects people, but it's not visible, and it's only like noticeable long term. So I think there are certain licenses that you need in order to, for like the spectator that knows nothing about it, to understand that it's causing like immediate damage, for example.
Yeah. Mm. Well, especially at the start of the story. I mean, I'm sure that if they revisit that sensation or reaction in other episodes, then they can afford to have a more slow burn approach to it, or show it in a different way. From what I've seen, I do like the fact how you see the explosion in the window of a woman's kitchen. And I've only seen half the first episode, but I'm assuming she's a recurring character because her husband is in the fire department. Or maybe she's not, the way you're looking at me.
No. I think you have a point that's coming.
I have a point that's coming? Well, it's just the whole idea is like, this is, in one sense, a nuclear reactor or a nuclear plant having this catastrophe is something that you can't really ignore. It's a huge explosion, big fireball in the sky. Mm. But they do a great job of showing how they try to cover it up in a lot of ways. How they try to spin the story, and even just the idiosyncrasies of the Soviet system, where experts were never really able to report the truth to their bosses. And then if they did, they were punished for it. And also showing how like, even the first responders going to the scene, this kind of dawning realization that something isn't quite right, and this kind of sense of what is actually happening. I think that is a very compelling component to that. So before we wrap up part two as well, part three, it doesn't matter, it's been longer than normal. But
I'm quite enjoying that.
Speaking of first responders, I would recommend seeing John Stewart's video where he's an advocate and a comedian, but he's an advocate for first responders in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He talks about how the response time for these people was 5 seconds to the towers, and he was in the Senate hearing fighting their corner to get recognition and financial support so they can treat their their health issues that have arisen from the gases and the jet fuel and the conditions of these two towers that were brought down, as we all know. And so it's just a very compelling, very passionate, very thought-provoking speech, and you can find it on YouTube. And he speaks with such eloquence because the first responders in this case have been largely ignored. And if you listen to Blind Boy's podcast this week, he talks about virtue signaling, where people like say maybe Black Lives Matters on a shop front, but then they step over a homeless person, and these politicians in America can easily tweet, you know, hashtag never forget, hashtag 9/11, hashtag heroes. But they're metaphorically or figuratively stepping over these people because they don't want to support their medical care. But, it's difficult to move on to the next part from that, but we must. So you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon. And you can find our blog as well on irishslicemadrid.com. And of course, you're already listening to this podcast on your platform of choice. And we're also on many other platforms as well. So, this time, this episode, part one was the normal length, part three a little bit longer. So I think we're going to have the three parts more or less the equal length. So we can have like tidbits in each part. So I think that could be interesting as well. Why not? It's what happened. It was out of our hands. Join us next week for another enthralling installments of the Elaborate Podcast. This is me saying good luck and bye-bye.
And maybe saying bye.
The Elaborate Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.